Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, March 14th, 2025, and I have the privilege to have Ambassador Chas Freeman and Colonel Lele Wilkerson back with us. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Thank you, Damon.
Let's get started with what Vladimir Putin responded to Donald Trump that asked Putin to spare Ukrainian soldiers in the Kursk region. And he mentions in his response that these people have committed numerous crimes against civilians, and these acts he considers as a terrorist attack, as terrorism that has happened on Russian soil. And if they lay down their arms, they're going to be guaranteed life and dignified treatment. And how, Ambassador Chas Freeman, how do you find the way that Vladimir Putin is trying to respond to Donald Trump, his response to the ceasefire, and right now to what Donald Trump asked about the Ukrainian soldiers?
Well, lots of atrocities happen in warfare. The battle in Kursk has been particularly ugly and has aroused a great deal of anger on the Russian side. I think, however, in Ukraine, the Russian military, for the most part, has been careful to treat Ukrainian prisoners pretty well in order to encourage defection. Here, I think this is a credible statement by Vladimir Putin. I'm glad President Trump called for mercy for the defeated Ukrainian military in Kursk, and I hope they get it.
Larry, go ahead.
Well, as I understand it, this was the creme de la creme of the Ukrainian military, or such as it was left after months of war. And so I suspect if it was that, they were fighting to the bitter death. But all along the line, I've heard that Putin has put out the word, the generals have followed that word, that it's very advantageous to Russia to get as many Ukrainians to surrender as they can. So the policy, as I understand it, is if you surrender and you make it known that you're surrendering, you'll be taken into custody and you'll be treated fairly well. That's a great propaganda technique and a great victory technique, because you bleed the enemy of its soldiers rather rapidly. Works probably a lot better along the main line of contact, where there are a lot of people who shouldn't be there in the first place, little training and so forth. But this group was pretty hardcore, and Putin's statement to me is a reasonable response to Trump's sort of cri de coeur for, you know, passion, and or not for passion, but for compassion.
I think it's going to be easy to implement. The Russian tradition is not one of kindness to invaders, and this is on Russian territory. Certainly the Soviet Union's army, the Red Army, was not very kind to the Germans whom it captured, or for that matter, to those Russians or other Soviet citizens who were captured by the Germans. And furthermore, the Geneva Conventions, which provide standards for the treatment of captured enemy soldiers, surrendered enemy soldiers, were pretty much done away with by us in Afghanistan with the invention of the concept of the enemy combatant not being entitled to the dignified treatment that Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin have called for. So I think we'll have to keep our fingers crossed. But one thing is clear, and that is the Ukrainian armed forces who invaded Kursk, as Larry said, were the very best that equipped, very best trained, best motivated that Ukraine had. Are being utterly annihilated.
Let me add one thing to that, Nima. I want to reinforce what the ambassador said about our having abandoned essentially all the work that we did from the Nuremberg trials in particular, all the way up to the time of 9/11, when my president, George W. Bush, was faced with a fairly well-explained choice, on the one hand by Donald Rumsfeld and the Vice President Dick Cheney, and on the other hand by Colin Powell, and to a lesser extent Dr. Rice, the National Security Advisor, and eloquently by Powell's lawyer at the time, Will Taft, William Howard Taft IV, a famous name in American politics, and also former undersecretary, or actually deputy secretary of defense. So he knew what he was talking about with regard to the Geneva Conventions. And we left him. We made a calculated decision right there on the spot to abandon essentially all the things we'd done since Nuremberg. And we had been the craftsmen, more or less, of that. And I don't think we've returned to it since, really.
No. It's actually, this is actually a very good illustration of why you should always consider what if the worst happens to you when you consider doing the worst to someone else.
Yep. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you is not a bad piece of advice for military operations.
Exactly.
When it comes to the first round of negotiations between the Americans, between the Trump team and Ukrainians, and which came out to be a ceasefire, a 30-day ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia, how, Ambassador, how did you find the way that Vladimir Putin tried to respond to this proposal on the part of Trump? Here is what they put on and the social media. You see the Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Emmanuel Macron, Ursula von der Leyen, and Kaya Kallas. They all put that the ball is now in Russia's court. And Russia has responded to what they were asking for. How did you find the response of Vladimir Putin?
Well, let me say it first that this is not a ceasefire between Mr. Zelensky and Mr. Putin, or between Ukraine and Russia. It's a ceasefire between Donald Trump and Vladimir Zelensky. That is to say, Zelensky agreed finally, after refusing for years to negotiate, he agreed technically to negotiate with the Russians. And the price of that was a resumption of military aid and intelligence support on our side. And I think Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump are in analogous positions. Neither wants to offend the other. Both see that the big prize is a broad rapprochement between Russia and the United States, which would benefit both countries. It's a much larger issue than Ukraine. Both undoubtedly would like to bring the war to a close in a peaceful manner. And so Mr. Putin has basically finessed the issue. He has remained true to the objectives he set at the outset in December 2021. He wants a peace, not a ceasefire. He will accept a ceasefire as part of a broader peace agreement. That peace agreement has to address the issue of Ukrainian neutrality and no presence of hostile forces, foreign forces, on Ukrainian soil aimed at Russia, no NATO in Ukraine, and it has to deal with the broader issue of security architecture in Europe that can reassure both the Russians and other Europeans against the threats that each perceives from the other. And of course, he also wants to protect the Russian speakers in Ukraine, most of whom he now controls in the four oblasts that he has occupied in whole or in part. So in this context, he said that there were nuances that had to be addressed. Well, actually, they're more than nuances. They're fundamental principles. And I think, but he did not rebuff the idea. He just put it in a broader context. I don't think we're going to see a ceasefire anytime soon. I have said repeatedly, and I continue to believe, that the pattern in Ukraine will follow that in the Korean War. That is, the fighting will continue while the negotiations proceed. I don't believe Russia will accept a temporary division of Ukraine. I don't think it will accept the demilitarized zone or the continued division of Europe into two hostile military blocs or hostile military bloc confronting Russia. This is going to be a very tough negotiation, and there's no easy answer to it. I guess I'd make a final point, and maybe Larry will disagree with me on this, but I think Mr. Trump has a habit of setting everybody else up to be blamed for whatever bad happens. And he's now in a position to posture against Mr. Putin, if he wants to do that, to say, well, he had a chance to have a ceasefire and he didn't take it, and to show the American people that he's not a stooge of Putin, as has been charged, but tough and not in the pocket of Russia. I think there are domestic political postures going on here on both sides. There are very hardline people in Moscow. There are very hardline people in the United States, some of them in the Trump cabinet. So this was an interesting play. Its major significance is the agreement of Mr. Zelensky finally to negotiate. Although I note that he immediately issued a statement saying he wouldn't negotiate anything about territory. I wonder what that left for him to negotiate, actually.
Larry, go ahead.
Well, I agree with what the ambassador said to a point. I listened very carefully to what Putin said in response, and you put up some of the remarks that were made by various actors. It was remarkable how well they had coordinated those remarks.
Yeah.
Even between Washington and Brussels. But what I see happening here is Putin somewhat enclosed by what's happened to this point and his own rhetoric and Trump's rhetoric and others' rhetoric, certainly not Zelensky's, but Putin being very smart in the way he responded to it. He didn't want to say, I don't want a ceasefire, but he laid out briefly, and if you listen to Sergei Lavrov, especially in the almost 2 hours with Judge Napolitano interview, if you listen to that and other remarks Sergei made, you understand that there are so many problems and challenges associated with this, not the least of which, and Putin was explicit in this, as was Lavrov, this is 2,000 kilometers. This is a long stretch of frontage, of which about 800 or whatever is really serious. And who's going to patrol that? Who's going to guard that? Who's going to provide security for that? Who's going to take care of people who commit infractions, especially if they're serious infractions? All these particulars need to be worked out. So I agree with the ambassador that the ceasefire may be just, you know, an instrument of futility, because if you can't work out all these details, let alone the serious things like he suggested, does Russia get to claim the entire oblast or just that it occupies? And oh, by the way, if that's what you're going to do, I think I'll just keep going until I get the whole oblast. There's some really, really serious details that need to be worked out. And Donald Trump does not do details, nor do I detect very many of his staff who do details. Not yet, anyway. I hope I do finally, but not yet. So I don't think we've made much progress.
I think we're in basic agreement, but I'm glad, Larry, that you pointed out the difficulties of reaching an agreement, even on a ceasefire. You've got to deal with POW, MIA issues. You have to deal with line of control. You have to demarcate that. You've got to find some way to monitor it. Perhaps we can monitor it from space. Certainly the Russians are not going to accept NATO troops monitoring it. They might accept NEMA, since you're a Brazilian, they might accept Brazilian troops, in which case I fear for your lives. But I think the troops, any troops of peacekeeping supervision, which may very well be necessary, would have to be under UN auspices, and it would have to draw probably on the global south rather than anyone on the Eurasian continent, per se.
And I would just add, Nima, my experience, most recent experience, was with the warlords in Somalia and UNPROFOR in the Balkans. And you throw somebody into that kind of an environment, even the best UN peacekeepers. And incidentally, the Fijians are probably the best I've ever seen at doing it, but they wouldn't even want to touch this one with a 9-foot pole, except for the money they get. They get a lot more money working for the UN than they get working for their own countries in many cases. But this is very difficult. If you don't have a peace to keep, it's really tough on the peacekeepers. And the less professional they are, that's no insult to Brazil or to Pakistan or to others that often participate for the UN. It's just to say that they are not the best forces when it comes to killing people. And that's to, you know, I'd say that's to their credit. But it's really difficult to do this sort of thing. Extremely difficult. And if it gets out of hand, then you've got to pull in other assets that go back to war with one another, essentially.
I think we are all being reminded that it, or we should be reminded by the situation in Kosovo and in Bosnia, that a truce is not the same as a peace.
Yep.
And a truce that has to be enforced with a garrison of foreign troops is more trouble than it's worth, very likely. There's a great deal to be said for what I think a British general said during the war in Bosnia. He said, you know, that there are three principles involved in intervening in civil wars, which that was. He said, one, don't. Second, if you do, pick the side that's going to win and hope it wins fast. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember the third principle, but that's sensible. This war really has to be brought to an end. And there are very big issues at stake. And they're not going to be solved by some 30-day peace ceasefire. And the notion that somehow or other you can't talk while you fight has been repeatedly refuted by history.
You know, look at the Israelis on the Lebanese border and how they treat the UN forces and vice versa. We had a distinction in the military that we tried to make, and it was a distinction of some interest before we actually got involved in it and found out it was a distinction that was meaningless in most cases. And that was chapter 6 versus chapter 7, you know, where the peace was there and you were keeping it. And the other one was where you peace enforced, you tried to enforce peace like in Mogadishu and elsewhere in Somalia. That's dangerous work. Very dangerous work.
Yeah. And you also, you do have a successful peacekeeping example in Cyprus.
Yep.
The principal result of which has been permanently to divide Cyprus and to prevent the reconciliation that should have happened.
Actually, I did my master in Cyprus. I know the situation.
Well, then you know.
Tell us about Cyprus, Nima.
It's amazing. Ambassador, when it comes to the way that this proposal, the proposal is for ceasefire, but why they have, you've mentioned that Ukrainians were asking for asking the United States to resume the send of the military military equipment and intelligence, provide Ukraine with weapons and intelligence. If Donald Trump isn't that confusing for Russians? At the same time that you're proposing a ceasefire, then you say that you're going to restore sending weapons and intelligence to Ukraine?
I don't see the contradiction. I think there's a ceasefire supposedly on offer now as part of a process which would include negotiations. But there is no ceasefire. And in the absence of a ceasefire, I think it's perfectly logical for some degree of support to continue. Basically, if you did not resume support, you would weaken the Ukrainian hand even more than it has been by the results on the battlefield to date. And I don't think that was the intention of the Trump administration.
I agree completely. And I also think there was a little voice over there saying politically expedient too for you to do that.
Lots of money for the merchants of death. Yes.
Yeah.
And what's problematic is the attitude of Zelensky. Ambassador, you mentioned Zelensky right after the agreement between Ukrainians and American. He said that they're not going to abide by that condition of Russia. It seems that during the talks, they agreed that if Russia asks for Ukraine not being part of NATO in the future, they're gonna talk about it or negotiate on it. But it seems that right after the negotiation, they rejected. They said Russia has no right to talk about NATO membership of Ukraine. How do you see the attitude of Zelensky? Is that problematic? Who's running the show? Is it Zelensky? Is it the United Kingdom? Is it MI6? I don't know. How do you find it? How do you see it?
I don't know who's writing Mr. Zelensky's scripts for him. That's always been a question, whether they were original with him or whether somebody was handing him things. But I do know a couple of things. First, the savaging of Mr. Zelensky in the Oval Office by Mr. Trump has considerably elevated Mr. Zelensky's popularity in Ukraine. Ukrainians have, to some extent, rallied around him, and that is a natural reaction. Second, his entire political career, that is following his successful comedy show, has been based on intransigence. You know, basically emulating the language of Winston Churchill, defiant. And I don't think he's learned how to say anything else. What would happen if he also, by the way, rejected the idea of any elections unless and until the war ends. So I think within Ukraine, he has adopted an expedient political posture. This is one that also unites him to the Europeans, because they continue to say silly things like victory is more important than peace. Actually, that was Anne Applebaum who said that, but it could well have been said by a European. And this is absurd, because there is no prospect of victory anymore for Ukraine, if there ever was. So I think he's basically trying to stand his ground. He wants to reconcile with Mr. Trump. He wants the continued support of the United States. He hasn't psychologically adjusted to the need to be somewhat conciliatory to the Russians.
Larry, do you think that they can get security guarantee the way that they're talking about NATO membership?
Nima, I think the first thing that, in my view anyway, that one has to realize about this entire mess, and it is a mess, is that the real belligerents are the United States, and lesser extent NATO, and Russia.
Correct.
They're the real belligerents. Zelensky and Ukraine, as courageous as they have been in the actual fighting, are an intermediary at best. They are the instrument of our attempt to bleed Russia, to go after Russia. For what reason, I have no earthly idea, none whatsoever, other than just a vitriolic hatred of the fact that Russia was coming back after we had crushed them, supposedly. We didn't crush them. Gorbachev made the Soviet Union end, not us. I mean, that's not a very popular opinion, but it is the opinion of most people who've written tomes on Gorbachev, Russian, European, or otherwise. And I think they're at least largely right. George Kennan's prediction that it would happen happened. And we might have aided it by staying stalwart and so forth, but the real person that did it was... Then they came back. They came back under Putin, an autocrat. So, bang, we've got to go after them. And we're using Ukraine as that vehicle. When you look at that and you think, who should be the negotiators here? Who should be the disputants at the table? And who should have the greatest weight in the disputes? I think you have to look at the belligerents. And in reality, if Ukraine hadn't had as many, I'm told it's close to a million now, casualties as it had, it wouldn't even have a place at the table, but it has a place at the table because of that commitment and that blood. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with that? Well, there are certain things that you are not going to be able to do come hell or high water, and that is make Ukraine a member of NATO. And von der Leyen and Macron and Starmer and Maris now, you can go to hell because you are not going to be able to make Ukraine a member of NATO. I don't care what your protocols are. You're not. Russia's willing to go to the wire for that. And there's some other things in there that they're probably willing to go pretty far for, too. Not least of which is what they've gained through their own bloodshed. 300,000 casualties, I'm told. KIA. Once you face that reality or those realities, I think you have to bring a different approach to these negotiations, whatever they're going to be, ceasefire, peace treaty, or whatever. And you have to understand that if you aren't willing to recognize each of these fundamental realities, you're going to get nowhere. And the BND, the head of the BND recently said it should go to 29 or 30. Well, why did he say that? Because that's when Trump will be gone, and they all think that when Trump is gone, they can resume this whole fracas. So that's the kind of crap you're dealing with.
So several comments. First, the essence of NATO is Article 5, that an attack on one member will be met with a force by every other member, will be treated as an attack on every other member. We've already shown that we're not prepared to go to war directly with Russia over Ukraine. So that question's been solved. Article 5 will never apply to Ukraine. Second observation, Larry's absolutely right. We did not defeat Russia in the Cold War. It defaulted on the contest for global hegemony. And it did it for exactly the reasons that George Kennan had predicted. Third point. It's absolutely correct that this is all about the nature of U.S.-Russian relations. Mr. Trump seems to see that. Mr. Putin has clearly shown that he sees that. The Europeans are therefore reduced to bystander status as the U.S. and Russia maneuver. And here I want to recall something. I think in 1995, I went to Beijing and I asked the Chinese Academy of Military Sciences for a briefing on Sino-Russian relations. And two very bright colonels gave me one of the best briefings I've ever heard. And they said, basically, Russia's on the way down, but it has yet to hit bottom. We think it'll hit bottom toward the end of the century. And then it's going to come back. And our whole strategy is to make sure when it comes back, it is not our enemy, but a cooperant, a country with whom we have peaceful relations and which does not pose a threat to our country. They had a strategy. We did not. We wobbled all over the place. We had a chance to achieve a genuine rapprochement. The only agenda we came up with was arms control, which is a fine thing, but it's premised on mutual enduring hostility. That is to say, we don't do arms control with the British because we don't imagine that they're going to come back and burn Washington down again as they did in 1812. So we never came up with a positive agenda. We never asked ourselves, what could we do with the Russians that we couldn't do before? What should we do with the Russians? We never asked that. And gradually over time, we resurrected the whole Cold War mentality. Despite efforts by the Russians in the earlier years, at least, to reach out and integrate themselves into the world order that we had sponsored and which we dominated. So this is all about the U.S. and Russia. Ukraine is, as Larry said, a tool of statescraft. You used the term instrument, I believe, but I'd say it's just a tool. Nobody ever talks about the poor Ukrainians. We conceal the level of casualties they've suffered. We don't talk about the depopulation of Ukraine, the suffering of the Ukrainians. We don't talk about the devastation of Ukraine's industry or agriculture. We don't talk even about Ukraine's famous corruption anymore. This just is a good illustration of the fact that both sides have used Ukraine to make a point. The Russians have used it to make a point that they won't tolerate hostile forces on their border. I'm not sure that, I'm sure there's been a great deal of rage and on both sides in Ukraine against Russians, again in Russia against Ukrainians. Rapprochement, reconciliation will not be easy, but it has to happen. And so Mr. Zelensky needs to understand that he needs to talk about reconciliation and about a reasonable basis for halting this fight or remain a tool of a struggle that he shouldn't be part of.
I think one of the main reasons right now that Donald Trump is trying to communicate with Russia is the relationship between the United States and Russia. And here is what Sergei Lavrov said in the interview that Larry mentioned earlier. Here is when it comes to the relationship between the United States and Russia, he has mentioned that in this clip.
We want normal relations. Normal relations in the sense that the foundation of the American foreign policy under the Trump administration is national interest of the United States. This is absolute and without any discussion. But at the same time, we understand that other countries also have their national interests. Right. And those countries who have their national interests and don't play into the hands of somebody else's interest,
right,
we are ready to have serious discussion. It is very well understood, they told us, that countries like the United States and Russia would never have their national interests the same. They would not coincide maybe even 50 or less percent. But when they do coincide, this situation, if we are responsible politicians, must be used to develop this simultaneous and similar interest into something practical which would be mutually beneficial, be it economic projects, infrastructural projects, something else. And then another message went. But when the interests do not coincide and contradict each other, again, this is then the responsible countries must do everything not to allow this contradiction to degenerate into confrontation, especially military confrontation, which would be disastrous for many other countries.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, my goodness. There's still at least one diplomat alive in the world.
I was thinking I was listening to Frederick H. Hartman or someone, you know.
Well,
Wang Yi both are probably the two premier diplomats in the world today.
I agree, but this is a classic statement of diplomacy. You seek common ground. You keep lines of communication open. You seek common ground. You seek to find areas where you can cooperate directly or by conducting policies in parallel to the same ends. And when you differ, you try to control the differences and keep them from exploding into conflict. And that is what he said. That is exactly what we should have done between the end of the Cold War and today with the Russians. If Russia really is prepared to take that approach, that is very encouraging.
When I was listening to that, Nima, I was looking at a couple of times the little pack of 3x5 cards he had. He very, very seldom looked at them, and he recited the history of the Ukraine conflict without hardly looking at the notes. But I wish there he had said, and it wouldn't have been an ancillary comment. It would have been a fundamental comment leading into what he said about interest. Where we have the most important mutual interest is in reducing our nuclear weapons stockpiles. we can work on that, which is where I think we ought to be headed quickly. I don't see that being set aside because of the Ukraine deliberations. I think we ought to get, you know, a summit or whatever we need, even invite the Chinese if they want to come. They seem to be amenable to at least listening, and then set up the working parties and get to business with this nuclear weapon. Because that's our greatest mutual interest.
I agree. And to Trump's credit, he has offered that. I think the Chinese, if treated on a basis of dignity and respect and as equals at the table, would join such a process. At the moment, they are, however, not in the same league as the two Cold War contestants. But Larry's absolutely right. That ought to be the primary objective.
Well, Larry, what can we expect from the Europeans? What do they want to be in this sort of negotiations between the United States and Russia? It seems that they're totally missing the point which was mentioned by Lavrov, is national interest. What is national interest for Europeans? Are they really seeking for that?
I think one of the things that we're missing, I heard someone the other day, I lost his name, but he was talking about this explicitly. We're not dealing with a single, probably, European country of note that is following the wishes of its people.
Right.
And their political systems are, in many cases, like Germany's, is really in need of major adjustment. France is too, of course. France does it every now and then, a new republic, a new government. But they don't represent, the leaders do not represent what the people want. If you look at the polls, it's probably as high as 60%. Even in Poland, I just saw a recent poll of Poland, it's 70% plus that don't want anything to do with the Ukraine war and want it over as soon as possible and don't want repercussions like Ukraine becoming a member of the EU too fast because the agricultural policy would swamp them. So why are these people saying what they're saying? Is it all about their own personal prestige? Is it all about their own personal fear? Or is it just usual, politics as usual? The head of Denmark made an egregious statement the other day about it's better to be dead than to have peace. I mean, that's essentially what she said. It's better to be dead than to have peace. What kind of a statement from that is? What kind of a statement is that from a leader of a country? And yet, that's what we're dealing with. I think that's the rawest nerve that I see, and I think that foretells the disintegration of NATO if they don't figure out some way to do it better. And just throwing up your arms and say, I'll go to 5% and I'll make bombs and I'll create a nuclear panoply you won't believe and so forth. That's nonsense. They don't have the money to do that. And they don't have the people's support to do that.
Well, better red than dead, better dead than red, whatever. Yeah, I mean, this has set some resonance in the Cold War. I think, Larry, that part of this, not the whole reason for it, is dependency syndrome. For 80 years, Europe basically was in a position to lean back and let the United States define the European order, protect Europe from risks, whether they were military, political, or economic. And, you know, that was a pretty comfortable position. And the key trick to doing that was to make sure that the United States was ingratiated. And so they want to ingratiate the United States. And Mr. Zelensky in particular learned to sing an entire libretto that was music to our ears. And he would come to Washington and denigrate the Russians and demonize Mr. Putin and so forth and so on. And then he came to Washington this time and the stage was not open for that kind of thing. And he did not adjust. And I think he was quite rightly confronted on that. Maybe not, I don't agree with the way in which he was confronted. But still, the fact is Europeans seem to believe that their prime interest is ingratiating themselves with Washington. And as you said, Larry, you know, they, at least the German military leadership appears to want the war to go on till 2029 so they can be rid of Trump and go at it again. This is just stupid. But all they're talking about, they are not one of them has a plan for peace. Not one of them is addressing the political implications or requirements for peace. Every one of them is talking about fantastic military deployments. I say fantastic because they don't have the troops. They don't have the capability. So this is all some kind of fantasy foreign policy, like fantasy football. You know, it's a lot of fun, but in the end, it isn't real. And so you get statements by Sir Keir Starmer saying, well, we're ready to go into Ukraine, boots on the ground. But of course, only if the Americans are there to protect us.
And I'm not sure you'd be able to even hear the boots of the British military.
Well, what are the 70,000 left now, I think?
If that, and think they, about, think about the future, and the future of any European security identity, if it were strictly based on the countries that we're looking at being friendly, and they had to implement conscription. They'd be no better than we are.
Right.
And we're so bad right now that we just lost a quarter of the United States Army at the 2-year point. A quarter of them elected to get out. And 50% of that quarter were graduates of the new programs, the Scholastic program and the WAIT program.
You know what?
The propensity to serve in the United States of America is 9% amongst 11 to 24, or 18 to 24-year-olds. And I'll bet you it's not much better in Europe, including Germany.
You know what? If you denigrate public service, whether it's in uniform or in civilian clothes, a lot of people are not interested in public service.
Yep. One of the answers on the propensity to serve ballot, as it were, came from a 19-year-old who is a sophomore in a university in the South. And he said, why would I want to serve in the United States military when it hasn't been involved in a war that was for anything other than the military industrial complex or a war that made sense in my lifetime? Mm-hmm. Great answer.
I don't think many people want to go and fight in the Eskimos and others in Greenland.
Yeah. I love that comment by Sergey.
Or Panama.
Sergey said, Ukraine is a lot more important to us than Greenland is to the United States.
Yes, he did.
Here is, today we've learned that Associated Press reported that the United States and Israel have discussed relocating Palestinians from Gaza to Sudan, Somalia, and Somaliland, according to U.S. and Israeli officials. What's going on with this new idea, with this sort of attitude on the part of the Trump administration, Ambassador?
Well, one has to assume that there is a cynical judgment that the Sudanese, who of course are engaged in a ferocious civil war, could nevertheless be bribed into accepting people. They need money. And the same might be said to be true in a divided Somali. I think this is grasping at straws. The whole idea of moving the Palestinian population out of Gaza has been greeted globally with horror and indignation. And it is not feasible, and we now have Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister in Israel, is saying, well, you know, we first of all, we'll try to starve them out. They cut off all the water and the food to Gaza, and we'll move them 5,000 a day until we get rid of all of them. So you have an open set of policies supported by the United States, advocated by the United States, of ethnic cleansing, genocide, and the like. And I find it, as an American, I find it absolutely disgusting and totally unacceptable.
Nima Haaretz was reporting in the latest one on my cell phone that Somaliland had denied categorically that they were.
No, these are not countries that are in condition to receive much of anyone. So this is not just cynical, but it's absurd.
Larry, we've learned from the latest interactions between Iranians received the letter of Donald Trump, and in which he had two options for them: negotiate, or we're going to fight you, we're going to destroy you. And we had the response from the Iranian Supreme Leader and the President of Iran that they're under the pressure, and the way that you're talking to us, we're not going to negotiate with you. What's going on, Larry, in terms of the way that Donald Trump is trying to deal with Iran?
Well, this is standard Trump, I think. You first make these belligerent threats, and then you soften a little, and you get some kind of opening. Did it with Kim Jong-un, if you recall. I think he's dealing with a different animal here, though, dealing with Javad Zarif and the new, not new anymore, the president of Iran. And another thing I was interested in listening to with regard to the sort of off-the-cuff conversation that they had in the lobby, Napolitano and Johnson and Sergey, was sort of a commitment to stand by Iran. I wouldn't doubt that for a second. I wouldn't doubt it for a second. So if there's tough talk from that side, and we're talking to the Russians about Ukraine, there's going to be tough talk from the Russian side, either at that meeting or inside meetings to that or somewhere. And I think they're serious. I do think they're serious. And having Israel making airstrikes inside Damascus, some would say Damascus is next to Jerusalem in the Muslim world as the city of note. The Israelis are making airstrikes on compounds inside Damascus and taking ever more land every day too, and making more statements every day and claiming in Lebanon that they're going to stay in 5 points. Thank you very much, Lebanese government. We don't care what you think. We're going to stay there. One could have predicted that because Lebanon is so weak, but the situation is growing more and more. I agree with Colonel McGregor on this. At first, I thought he was a little bit off, but I think he's right that it's growing more and more ripe for a reaction that no one is counting on. No one is counting on a concerted action, even by more than the Houthis, and an action against the IDF, which is already strained and stressed. They're going back to war with Hamas again. That's the warning orders are already out. The divisions are set and primed to go. And they don't plan on going into a stage two. And the hostages be damned. The side talk is essentially, I think, about Americans now. It's about the one they're going to get alive and maybe four or five bodies they're going to get of dual citizens out of the talks that the U.S. was doing directly. So I think we're going to re-enter the same situation we were in before this temporary ceasefire. But I think the Arabs are getting primed, and maybe the Turks too. And that would be catastrophic, I think. The United States would have one hell of a decision to make there. I've no doubt the decision we would make, but it would be a hell of a decision because Iran's going to be in it too. I mean, you're talking about a panoply of forces opposing Israel from the Philadelphia quarter all the way around to Lebanon and perhaps even deep into Syria.
Three comments. First, the Houthis are already back to enforcing their blockade in the Red Sea. They have embarrassed every other Arab country by standing up, actually taking a hit for the Palestinians, the Lebanese, and now the Syrians. Second, I think Whether or not there is a broad conflagration of the sort that Doug McGregor fears, I don't think he's unrealistic at all in those fears. The fact is, and this is the third point, that there is a broad coalition against Israel coming into being in the region. Everybody is offended by Israeli behavior and statements. Nobody finds them acceptable. Those countries that have relations with Israel are reconsidering them. Those who don't are certain they will not establish relations. So the Abraham Accords project for the foreseeable future is sidelined. Israel is isolating not just itself, unfortunately, but us. Because the real question is, why are we supporting all of this aggression and expansion and racism and apartheid and human rights violations and genocide? I think it's a shameful thing for us to be doing. And the world sees it that way.
Larry, do you think that in terms of having, let's be optimistic that Donald Trump can get an agreement with Iran? How, when you look at, when you zoom out, you see the outcome of that sort of agreement and the consequences or the outcomes of this agreement for the region and how they can manage the situation in the region. They can come to an agreement. We know that Iran is a party in this conflict. Is that possible to get together to find a solution for what's going on in Gaza?
Well, if Donald Trump wants the art of the deal to extol his presidency, that would be it. And I think he does. I think he would love to give the back of the hand to President, Vice President then Biden and President Obama, who achieved the JCPOA. And I think Iran is in a position to help him, if it's done smartly. Here are the great impediments. First and foremost, Israel. And Israel is not going to agree with that at all. And they're going to try every way they know to foul it up. I met with President Ahmadinejad in New York when he was in New York for the General Assembly. And I met with his foreign minister. And I met with several people who were on his team. And I was convinced at that time. The foreign minister looked at me, he leaned in English, he said, if we have to operationalize, that's a good word, isn't it? And he smiled. He knew I was military. If we have to operationalize our fatwa and take it to the UN and sign it in blood in front of you, the other members of the permanent members of the Security Council, and the Secretary General, we'll do that. We find nuclear weapons to be anathema. So that's going to be a hell of a decision for Iran if they don't go for an agreement and get something out of it, like sanctions relief, which is primarily what they want, and they have to build a bomb. But I have no doubt that they would probably go ahead and do it. Other forces would prevail and they'd go ahead and do it. So all to say, this is an important side note, but it's probably even bigger than the if it weren't a genocide, I would say that, than the issue being contested in Gaza right now. And if he can achieve that, more power to him. But Netanyahu is going to be the obstacle. And I suspect any Israeli leader who follows Netanyahu, because I think his hold on power is growing more tenuous with every hour that passes. How do you do it? He'll do everything he can, or his successor will do everything he can to screw it up. And that means just about anything you want to drag out of the hat, he'll do to screw it up.
That's one thing the Israelis excel at.
Yes.
They really do. I agree with you, Larry. I think in the case of Iran, the supreme national interest is national dignity and national identity, those two things. By insulting the Iranians, we do not help ourselves. By threatening them, we do not help ourselves, especially because in the first Trump administration, he tore up a solemnly negotiated agreement which had been approved by the UN Security Council and therefore had the status of international law. And he just ignored everything and trashed it. And this, I think, Mr. Pezeshkian, as well as the supreme leader in Khamenei in Iran, have both referred to his unreliability as a negotiator. So this is a burden which can't be overcome with the kind of approach that letter evidenced, at least in my opinion.
You know, Nima, yeah. it's a side product of Trump that everyone in the world virtually is waiting him out. In other words, their policy portfolio is three more years and a few months.
Larry, just to wrap up this session, the situation in Syria and the land that Israel is occupying right now is just unbelievable. That you look at the size of the land, and how do you see the way that Turkey is behaving right now? What do they want from Syria? What are they trying to do in Syria?
Well, Israel's air force dominates Syria. I mean, period. They dominate Syria. You don't need ground troops in that kind of a situation to dominate the terrain. You might not be able to hold it, and you might not be able to suck it dry of water and everything else, which they want to do. That's the reason they're moving the troops in. But in terms of the Air Force, you can't do anything without being bombed, and bombed relentlessly. Erdogan has been all over the map. I have no idea what Erdogan is going to do from Monday through Friday. Apparently, he has a deal now with those elements of the terrorist Kurds that he was trying to deal with. And so he's free, at least in that respect, to do what he wants to do, to threaten what he wants to threaten and to move troops or armored columns or whatever to support the government, which he keeps saying he wants to do in Damascus, the present government. So I don't know how to answer your question other than he's a factor sitting out there on the border or close to it. And we've got what someone told me the other day, over 1 million and 1.8 million or something like that, Syrians who've, you know, poured back into Syria. And now they are not finding very much in the way of sustenance, water, food, or anything else because the government can't provide it yet. And we still have sanctions on them.
Yep. That's the key point. I think the only answer really for Syria is one that is extremely unlikely, and that is someone provides an effective air defense.
Yeah.
But who's going to do that? As long as Israel feels free to bomb and strafe in Lebanon and Syria and in Gaza and now in the West Bank as well, it's just going to continue doing more of the same because it's essentially cost-free.
If Putin weren't really busy elsewhere, he might take that on.
Right. I don't see it happening.
Yeah.
Russia and China, especially Russia, has been removed from the region by this war, with this conflict. They are totally distracted from the situation in the Middle East. Yeah.
And, you know, it's remarkable. It's not incomprehensible at all, but it's remarkable that China is the probably number one power in the world right now in so many respects that matter. And it is not doing anything but using its diplomatic voice on occasion. Setting a role model for the world in many respects as to how things ought to be done. I would hate to see them have to pitch in somewhere because that doesn't seem to be their inclination, their predilection, or otherwise. Chaz can say this much better than I, but my perception was that the military in China was gaining so much stature and so much power that we were going to see eventually, though I didn't feel like the leaders wanted it, a military-industrial complex push on the Politburo that would cause them to become very different than their character bespeaks mostly. And yet I haven't seen that. I've heard a couple of retired admirals in Hong Kong and a couple of retired generals speak very aggressively about what China should be doing, but I haven't seen it in actions. They're setting a role model for the world, really, in my view. They're not in any wars. They don't have anybody under sanctions. They're doing fairly well. They speak with a diplomatic voice of high stature through Wang Yi and others. Why can't the rest of us emulate them?
Well, I think it's interesting, Larry, years ago, when the Chinese military upper staff colleges taught power projection as a foreign military doctrine. I don't think they have any great desire to displace us. In some ways, they are displacing us just because they're growing so fast and so powerful. And I think they want the prestige of the ability to do something like Teddy Roosevelt did with the Great White Fleet. But I don't see them wanting to do much except defend themselves and build their own prosperity and advance. I think this whole paranoia in the United States about the Chinese wanting to replace us as hegemons on the global level says more about us than it does about the Chinese. Anyway,
I agree 100%.
They're certainly benefiting from the contrast between their steadiness and our erratic behavior.
Sergey made a comment about the Secretary General of NATO talking in the early days of, when was it, maybe 5 or 6 years before the Ukraine war broke out, and saying that NATO was fundamentally a defensive alliance. And then the next words out of his mouth were China. Mm-hmm. China's the threat. NATO's a defensive alliance. China's the threat. We need to pitch in.
Yes. Well.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Ambassador Chas Freeman and Colonel Wilkerson. Great pleasure, as always.
A pleasure for us. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.